Good morning. Welcome to the third and amazingly final. This has been the fastest little series ever. Class, Life Together, The Nature of Christian Community, an exploration of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's classic spiritual work, Life Together, but also an exploration of the nature of authentic and healthy Christian community. So, I have learned that these three-week series are quite ambitious. I think that this could have used another 2 or 3 weeks. So I will remember that. We are always learning, like, how to do this, how to fit into our program calendar classes that explore things with depth and intentionality. And sometimes you think something's going to work, and then you get to the end of it, and you realize you only scratched the surface. So it is what it is. Today, we're going to do a little bit of recap of what we've explored leading up to now. Dick, I think there's a chair right here on the front row for you, sir. Oh. I want to do a very quick recap of the first 2 weeks of what we've talked about, and then try to pivot into an exploration of how Life Together, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's work and his wisdom, has been applied in various ways in different communities internationally, both in the United States and internationally. And then hopefully in the last several minutes to think about what it might look like for us. What it might look like. What's the wisdom for those of us who aren't necessarily pondering moving into one of these types of communities? What's our takeaway? So, a reminder that Life Together flows out of an experiment by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the great 20th century German Lutheran saint and martyr, who came of age in the 1930s during and overlapping the time of the rise of the Third Reich in Germany, and the way that the predominant church in Germany, the Lutheran Church, was essentially co-opted to become a sort of a puppet for espousing German Nazi ideology. And so Bonhoeffer resisted that. And part of that, come on in. I think there's a chair here for you, Elaine. Part of that was an experimental seminary at a place called Finkenwald. And at Finkenwald, for 2 years, Bonhoeffer was able to dabble in the kind of authentic community he believed was necessary to form the types of deeply rooted and grounded Christians who would have the spiritual wisdom, the spiritual capacity and understanding and depth of faith to push back against what he perceived were these tremendously egregious collapses of real faith, of real courage. There should be some chairs right there. And so he establishes this seminary for the training of, presumably, of confessing church pastors at Finkenwald. It lasts for 2 years and is eventually closed by the SS. Over the next several years, he starts to crystallize the thoughts that he had had, the wisdom he had gleaned from that experimental community at Finkenwald, and that translates into Life Together, a short classic of the nature of Christian community, and Carolyn would love for me to say available in the bookstore. So, if you are interested in learning more about the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I commend to you this particular work, Strange Glory, a magnificent work of scholarship, but also a wonderful and accessible read. I think that this book, as I've told you before, The Cost of Discipleship, is among the most important works of my life, and formative and influential works of my life. And here I will plug.
Thank you. Werner Frankfurt Library is doing a book discussion on Cost of Discipleship. I have some flyers. First Thursdays in November, so November 3rd, 10th, and 17th. I'll just leave the flyers somewhere.
What library?
Werner Frankfurt on Frankfurt and Preston.
So, Plano area? Yeah. Here.
Okay. It's not yet on the website. It'll be there.
Thank you, Rob. I also commend to you letters and papers from prison in the same way that that I feel like the letter from the Birmingham jail is perhaps Martin Luther King's most important work, piece of writing, piece of declaration. I think that some of Bonhoeffer's writing from within the sort of crucible of imprisonment after he had been imprisoned is some of the most profound. And so there's that. Last week we looked at some of the wisdom of the first several chapters in the book, and I wanted to summarize a few of those for us this week in case there are some who weren't able to be with us last week. So, all right. Bonhoeffer was interested in figuring out how to live intentionally together in close proximity, in a way that would deeply enrich all members of the community and be a part of that lifelong arc of formation and growth. And for Bonhoeffer, he was deeply influenced by his experiences, if you remember me talking about this, his experiences of monasticism, traditional monasticism. He was quite fascinated by it. And I think were he not so really rooted in his German Protestantism, he might have ultimately considered it. But he was very much a Protestant at heart, and he never really entertained that seriously. But he was able to glean from that type of life, that intentional life, what I would say that ruled life. How many of you are familiar with a rule of life? So the idea comes largely from Benedict, sort of the patron saint of monasticism in the West, at least. And Benedict wrote a rule in the early centuries of the church, like the 5th century, in which he realized that if you're going to live together in tight Christian community, and in that iteration, in a traditionally vowed monastic community, there needs to be some rules. And so think of rules like a list of rules, and also think of rules as in like a broad rule, that the collection of all of those rules, which form a cohesive unit. And Benedict wrote his, it's probably the most famous rule of life to ever be codified in the Christian church, and it enumerates lots of ideas and lots of specific practices that are required. It's like the discipline that's required to live in community. Bonhoeffer's influenced by that. His rule is not so specifically enumerated or codified. His is going to be a little bit more broad. He's going to adopt some of these ideas, but essentially what he wants to do is create a rule of life that governs and guides a community of people so that you're not necessarily always just making it up as you go or making decisions based on whim or fancy. And so he wants to embrace this idea of traditional monasticism but interpret it creatively. He starts from a place of, I read to you this quote last week, Christians are a source of incredible joy and strength for fellow believers. He starts from this place of yearning to be in Christian community. And for him, that's the root and ground, like that we need one another, profoundly need one another. But he also starts from the place of that this is not fantasy. And that was, I think, some of the nexus of the most interest last week was when Bonhoeffer writes about that these communities aren't supposed to be little fantasy communes where we're all just going to get together and, like, I don't know, hug each other and it's just going to be idyllic. Bonhoeffer was a realist, and he knew that if we enter into this communal living coming from this place of fantasy, of this idealized dream we have for what it should be, then we're going to very quickly become disillusioned and it's going to shatter everything about our experience. And so he's very real, even as he holds this high theology of the church, that the church really is authentically Christ's presence in the world, that we right now are Christ, are the body of Christ. I mean, he wholeheartedly believes that. And he also wholeheartedly knows that we're a mess and that, this isn't going to be some sort of like sunshine and lollipops all the time. That real people living with one another in close proximity is difficult work. So he orders this around a sort of rule of life. How is the day going to be organized and ordered? What are the expectations? What are the requirements to be part of the community? Just like in a family environment in which everybody in the household is expected to sort of do their share, pull their part, perform their roles, so the same goes for authentic Christian community. And so he organizes it around the day together and the day alone in the book. And I think that's how he organized his own thoughts when he was leading Finkenwald. The day begins and ends with extended times of prayer that are rooted and grounded in the reading and contemplation of Scripture, with periods of quiet and meditation, long periods of quiet and meditation, such that actually that's one of the things that the students of Finkenwald were like, yeah, about that, Bonhoeffer. It's like 30 minutes just sitting around together. It's a little awkward. So, because this is a group of a bunch of Protestants, and they're like, this is weird. So, accountability was very important in the way of holding one another accountable. Confession said to another person, and in this community, there wasn't a priest there. I mean, he was a pastor, but they all didn't make their confessions to him. You had a confessor within the community, and you had a confessing relationship with a fellow member of the community, which is profoundly vulnerable and also so deeply holy. And he knew that that was fundamental to have that that type of openness and vulnerability and confession. A reliance on praying the Psalms. He actually writes this beautiful book. The Psalter becomes very much central to Bonhoeffer's own spirituality and practice. And singing, because he's a German Lutheran, so he loved to sing. And he had supposedly had a beautiful voice. And so the day was bookended around that. He also organized the day alone, that not only should you do this together in meaningful ways every day, but you should also have time, quiet time alone, to pray and reflect individually. And it was in these instances that he said that you might take a single passage or a single verse or a single phrase and ruminate on that, meditate on that, almost like holding on to a saint, perhaps even a phrase for a whole week, and really deeply ponder that, even as while you're with the whole group, you might read 12 chapters of something or a whole book of the Bible together over the span of that week. Individually, you might read nothing but a single verse over and over and over each day, prayerfully engaging that. And he thought that that was important, that balance. And then in the midst of this, of course, they're students. So they're going to school, they're taking classes, but this would presumably, you know, you would go to work. You would go about your day. You would do the things that are necessary for you to do in the course of your day. What Bonhoeffer does not do in life together, that's why this is not technically a rule. It's more of a spiritual reflection. What he doesn't offer is specific instructions about finances, property disputes, who does the chores, organization or administration. He, interestingly, leaves all those, you know, sort of important details out of this little book, which is probably why it is, you know, 100 pages instead of 500 pages. Theoretically, some of that was simplified because of the nature of this particular community. But others who wanted to dabble in this, who wanted to embrace this, this idea, this concept, this practice, had to do the hard work of figuring out all of those practical things for themselves. So, who does the cooking and the cleaning? Where do you get the money to go, like, to make this work? And how do you share that equitably? Where do you find the piece of property to live in? This was donated in Finkenwald for a time until it was confiscated by the SS. Where do you get the house? How is it organized? Who's in charge? Who makes decisions? All stuff like that. So this community ends around in 1937, and he writes Life Together. Coincidentally, oh, and here's our man. Coincidentally, around the same time, in France, There is another community just beginning. It begins in a couple of different places, but it eventually lands at Tize. Have you ever heard of Tize? It just like jumped out of my head. Brother, Roger, thank you. Roger. Brother Roger is actually another Protestant, Swiss born, and he, in the same decade, he feels called to the same type of intentional living, and he eventually gathers around him a couple of other men who are similarly called, feel similarly called to an intentional way of holy living. And there's just a few of them at first, and at one point they're in like Geneva, and then they move back to France, and then they come across this piece of property, and the community slowly begins to accrete, primarily once we get to the other side of World War II. During World War II, the small band of brothers who haven't taken formal rules, but they have a semi-rule of life. They're harboring Jewish refugees, and they're living out a type of ruled life that looks very monastic. Eventually, it becomes very much monastic traditionally. But it's starting out just with this realization that these men, in the world of World War II and leading up to World War II, the crisis of the world, the chaos of the world, they feel this need to be grounded in their lives daily. And so Brother Roger calls them together and becomes this remarkable movement, essentially. Tize is one of the most remarkable Christian communities in the world. And it has evolved over its history from those early decades, and now is well over 100 brothers still living in Tize. It is essentially an ecumenical monastery. That is, the men come to it from a variety of different ecclesial backgrounds. They come from many of them are Roman Catholic, but not uniformly. Roger was himself Protestant, although he very much was a part of the Roman Catholic Church in his relationships. But brothers come from Protestant world, the Orthodox world. They come from all different. How many of you have been to Tize? What was it like, Nancy?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. Tize service.
Oh, okay. How many of you have ever been to Tize in France? So, because of the spirit in which the brothers live, Brother Roger called the community, he wanted it to be a parable of reconciliation. A parable of reconciliation. He wanted their lives together as a community to so utterly manifest the nature of grace and graciousness and love and charity and reconciliation, that their lives together would speak in and of itself to the world. And by God, it has. It's an enormous pilgrimage site, primarily for young adults. They have held as their driving focus trying to be a witness to the young people. And by that I don't mean young people in like we do in the Episcopal Church, which is anybody under 50, we're going to call them young. in this sense, it's really in your teens and 20s. And they welcome thousands upon thousands upon thousands every year to come and to stay with them in guest houses, and to live with them for a time, and to experience their practice of prayer. These brothers take vows. They actually have a rule of life. Brother Roger's rule is one of the most beautiful, shorter than this even, rules. But it is ecumenical, so it is not necessarily tied to a particular church. So this is happening. Brother Roger, at the same time Bonhoeffer is writing, and we know that they kind of know of each other a little bit, but not much, because it's the chaos of Europe in the 1930s and 40s. Brother Roger leads the community for over 50 years today. You can go visit it. I will say there's no one in here under 30, I don't think. We would all stay in a different place than if you were 30 or under. You have closer proximity to the lives of the brothers if you are 30 or under, because they want to help form Christians, and they understand that to be very important. We have several people in the church who have been, and it is just a profound experience. So,
it's too much of a coincidence. There is a Tuesday service at 6 o'clock tonight at St. Thomas the Doubter Mother Joyce Church. So, if you'd like to witness Tuesday service.
So Tuesday is famous now in places like Transfiguration for the style of their worship, and primarily for Jacques Bethier's music, which is that repetitive chant. So we do incorporate it here. This is their chapel, which they've had to expand so many times because it has to. It was made for brothers, and then they were like, okay, well, other people want to come, and they kept having to blow out walls, and now it's just essentially a building with tents that extend out, and they'll have 5, 6, 7, 10,000 people who gather at a time in the countryside of Burgundy. It's magnificent. You have, at the same time, a Scottish Presbyterian pastor who is also feeling like the church in Scotland in the 1930s is completely inept to deal with the problems that are facing, actually even earlier than the 30s. He actually begins in the teens, and he's recognizing the challenges of urban environments with all these pastors and elders in these churches in Edinburgh and Glasgow primarily. And he's like, they're living in like la-la land, and you've got people in the most utter despairing poverty, and we're just like going about it like there's nothing going on. And he saw the way that the church was just dying on the vine. And so what this man did is he felt called to equip the church to be just like Bonhoeffer did. He saw that what was lacking was actual depth, spiritual depth, like real core, deep down within you, the reserves of faith and courage to go back out into those congregations that were challenged in so many ways, and the congregations and the people who were challenged in so many ways, and the pastors who were going there had this thin veneer of faith. And he was like, they just evaporate in the midst of these challenges. And he knew that something was needed to ground and root deeply in Christ these pastors and Christians in Scotland. And so it just so happens that Scotland, the sort of Christian history of Scotland in many ways originates in this little island, Iona. How many of you have been to Iona? Just a few. So way out in the middle of nowhere off the west coast of Scotland is this place called Iona. And it had, by the point of the late 1800s, early 1900s, was mostly in disrepair. It was had mostly been abandoned. And he gathers people together to rebuild it. And the folks would come and live there for a summer or for a year and order their lives around a rule, and then go back into the congregations or communities from which they came with the hope that they were then more deeply rooted and better equipped spiritually to face the challenges and opportunities that they did. Eventually and very quickly it became, it evolved out of just being men, and women were welcome because very quickly women craved that same experience. And the Iona community today is an